Welcome to Desert Island Tech, a podcast from Sight and Sound Technology, where we talk to people with disabilities to find out how technology has shaped their lives.
Hello and welcome into episode number 5 of the Desert Island Tech Podcast from Sight and Sound Technology. My name is Stuart Lawler and it's great to be back in the sweltering heat of a third week in July, but we're absolutely loving it. I hope you're safe and well wherever you are. Today's guest is one that I'm absolutely delighted to introduce, Mike Brace, CBE, who has held a number of senior positions across the UK in the charity and sight loss sector, and he's a keen sportsman. Mike joins us today to talk all about his life. Mike, welcome to the show.
Well, great to be here.
I was thinking this morning, actually, I was reading the bio on your website and there was lots of mentions of Paralympics. This must be a kind of an exciting time of the year for you as you get ready to watch Paralympics. Are you excited about it?
I am. I think obviously it's going to be very interesting. They were making a big play on the Olympics saying that got to get used to competing in empty stadia. Well, Paralympics have been used to competing in empty stadia until London. And then that really broke the back of that. To get 180,000 in a day watching Paralympics was just phenomenal. So I think there will be some adjustments for everyone.
Yeah, it really did, wasn't it? I think London was a huge one, and we might come back to that later. Actually, as we record, the opening ceremony of the Olympics are just about taking place around now in an empty stadium in Tokyo. So yeah, very strange for everyone, I'm sure. Can we go right back, Mike? Because I know you weren't born blind. In fact, you were born fully sighted, and then a terrible... I was going to say an accident, but it wasn't even an accident. It was like someone doing something for a joke that just was horrible.
Yeah, well, just playing football over the local park, saw some kids gathered around, looking down something on the floor. I went over and said, "What are you doing?" I think they did tell me to get lost or worse to that effect. Mm. I ignored them and saw on the floor a black medicine bottle. And I wasn't, I must have been slightly, confused or whatever, because I bent down to pick the bottle up to see why they were looking at it. And unfortunately, just as the firework inside it then blew up, so the glass then cut my face and my eye, one eye, went off to hospital, had it treated, got sent to Moorfields and got admitted. And basically, they tried to save the sight of the eye that was injured. Then I developed a thing called sympathetic ophthalmia and uveitis in the eye that wasn't injured, and that eventually deteriorated over a few months to no vision. Had a bit of sight in the part in the eye that was injured, and then at a football match I blew a trumpet to celebrate my team. Okay. And unfortunately the pressure of blowing the trumpet then hemorrhaged the back of the eye, detached the retina, and I woke up totally blind.
How does that I'm just trying to understand you're 10, you're 11, whatever, you're losing your vision presumably very quickly, overnight, all this stuff is happening, your parents have to adjust, you have to adjust, you're at this, just at the stage where you're wanting to get involved in so many things. Do you remember what that was like? Because it must have been incredibly difficult.
No, I do. I felt as though everything, all your norms has suddenly gone. I couldn't go back to the school that I'd been to. I couldn't play out in the same way with my friends because basically I couldn't see enough to do that. I still rode my bike just about. But again, that started to get more and more dangerous. And then you're suddenly shunted off to a boarding school in those days. And for me, that's where the biggest changes happen. One, the attitude changes, getting on a bus and hearing people talking about you as though you couldn't hear them and you didn't exist was a real red rag to me as a 11, 12-year-old. And I think that's been a good thing that's kept me going over many years. And the other side of that is sport. I was a sports fanatic. I went to the special school. First day, nearly got knocked down by someone on a go-kart and then by kids on roller skates. And I suddenly thought, blind kids can do things. And I just didn't have a clue.
Yeah.
I'd never met a blind person. I'd never seen anyone that was with sight loss. And suddenly I'm with these kids that were doing all these things, football, cricket. And that was, for me, the saviour. You know, that really started to put me back together, a bit like Humpty Dumpty.
Mm.
I used sport to firstly look at what my abilities still were, because everyone around you told you what your disability was, but no one told you what your ability was.
I'm just thinking of you saying, you know, that, for example, when you got on the bus, people were looking at you. And maybe you, as a 9-year-old or 8-year-old child before this accident, were probably doing the very same if you happen to see a blind person.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't actually remember seeing a blind person. I don't think they allowed us out in those days. You know, with the odd wheelchair or older person that were obviously had physical disabilities. But I, again, in Hackney, where I grew up in London, you know, very much in terms of rammed into a smallish area. We had, you know, a house, etc. And you just weren't aware of. You know, there weren't stair lifts for physical adaptation. So you just didn't know or didn't hear of anyone with disabilities.
I want to just maybe jump forward to the start of your career. And there's a piece on the website which talks about you you got a job as a typist and you realized within 2 weeks you didn't like it. Was it just like, did you sit there going, this is not for me? I can't go in and do this every day. Did that kind of give you the get up and go to say I need to do something more?
It was largely that. You know, the good side was I was a young boy sitting in a typing pool with 20 women, so that was a lovely
fair enough
introduction. But you know, the shorthand, I'd got all sorts of speeds because I heard that you got more money the faster you could do shorthand. So I had speeds of, say, 140 words a minute, and the average dictation was 20 words a minute. So you could almost drop off during the, you know, during going back and typing it back, and then there was no work. So I'd listened to the radio, I'd started doing my studies because it just was so boring. And so that's the spur, really. And as you say, I realised I was in the civil service, and I realised I wasn't very civil and I was no one's servant. And so I thought I had to do something. But in those days, education in the special schools that I went to, so I didn't go to the grammar school streams, was pretty limited. I think I left with equivalent of 3 O-levels in 1967, and that was the most in the history of the school.
Wow.
And that wasn't really going to get you very far. So I got my shorthand and typing, and then I thought, well, I've got to do something to get out of here. So 6 years later, having studied for 2 A-levels, I then managed to get those and suddenly thought, right, I'm not as stupid as I think I am or others do, so I'll apply to do social work.
What was the studying like, the education experience? Because presumably you were going back to do the A-levels in mainstream. I'm just thinking about, for example, how did you access material? Were people good around you? Were people supportive?
Well, it wasn't mainstream, really. I did a correspondence course, and by the nature of it, everything was in print. So I had to get my wife to fiance to then go through and read stuff for me, and family members, etc. So that was incredibly difficult doing the A-levels. And then I did a evening class, which basically my wife took the notes for, and I just slept through and then looked at the notes. In the college, it was incredibly difficult because, again, no computers. So you're reliant on the materials of books and stuff, and fairly limited in the subjects in psychology and sociology from RNIB in Braille. A few on talking books, but not very much. So again, you had to rely on other students and getting people in to help read through, and then you typed up all your assignments. So at least that was one skill I had. I could type. And therefore my essays usually were better presented than those that hand wrote them. So, you know, that was about the only advantage, I think.
you always have to work harder when you have a disability, don't you? I think when you're blind, when you're trying to access material, you're trying to keep up to pace with everybody else. You need to put in more hours. Did you find that? Were you working so much harder? Yeah.
I very much so. You started to do more and more. I think the other thing which really did strike me, and that's interesting with now the growth of technology and Facebook and things like that. What was pointed out to me was that when we were into debates, when we were arguing issues within the college, a couple of people said, what do you think? And then when I told them what I thought, they said, no, that's the BBC's stance on it. What do you actually think about it? And I suddenly realised how much my opinions and views really were shaped by the generic media. And of course, in those days, you couldn't read a newspaper, so there was no range of opinion. There was very little sort of general debate on people putting converse views to anyone else. And so you almost trotted out the BBC view of the world because that was my main source of information and influence.
Tell me about going into working, starting as a social worker, going right up to manage the whole service. But was back in the day, did people say, oh my God, a blind social worker, will that work? I mean, what, did you have any prejudices when you went into the workplace?
Yes, that was really quite difficult. I mean, getting into a job was difficult enough. And luckily I was on a sponsorship scheme where certain boroughs sponsored social workers going through the training. And the reason I did that was then they were really more indebted to take you on at the end of the training. So that meant that they had less choice to say. But I did look at two or three boroughs. One of them then accepted me. And yes, I had more issues from my colleagues, I think, than ever I did from the users that
from
I worked
the clients,
with.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They really weren't sure. What they tried to do was almost shut their eyes and wondered how they would do their job with their eyes shut. And of course, that isn't what being blind is like. You know, you've developed a range of skills and orientation and et cetera, et cetera. But their imagination was really clouded by a very limited view. Whereas when you were out and some of the kids that were truanting would wait for me to show me where to go in the different visits that I was doing.
Wow.
When I had kids in care, I could get them to read to me the football results or whatever, and they would never ever have voluntarily read to any other adult. But it was a legitimate thing to do that with the blind, and of course I probably milked that for all it was worth, but it was a way of interacting with the kids.
I wonder though, as you mentioned that, did it for the kids, was it something like they ultimately they viewed you presumably as someone who was going to help them, like any other social worker? Probably didn't matter to them that you were blind, and in some ways it was probably something different that brightened up and maybe it was something that maybe made a mark on them for their future.
I think that's true. I think the many of them were very suspicious of adults generally. I think some of them had been abused by them, et cetera, et cetera. And I think suddenly I was slightly out of the mold. I was I was in my 20s and 30s. I was, yes, I was blind. And therefore, there was a partnership more than a descending adult, because they then did some guidance. They would have to describe things for me, et cetera, et cetera. So That issue with the kids certainly was a key issue. And 30, 40 years later, I've been contacted by some of the kids that have then gone and got access to the records, and they've contacted me. And you're pretty overwhelmed, because you didn't talk about situations then, but 30, 40 years later, you know, telling you how much you meant at that stage in terms of, you know, something external from their awful existence.
That must have been, when you have those conversations with people far later in their life and you realize, hang on, my input was key into this person being where they are now, and now we're having the conversation about what that meant to them.
Yeah.
Must be really important.
You're listening to Desert Island Tech, a podcast from Sight and Sound Technology.
Can I talk to you a bit about Vision 2020 UK? And I know you've You worked there and you were the CEO before you finished up. And I suppose, idea of trying to get a number of charities right across the UK to collaborate and to work together. And please correct me if I'm wrong in how I explained that. But I know that in Ireland here, and it's a far smaller country, far smaller VI charities, it's a challenge sometimes to get charities to work together, because everybody, you know, fundraising is competitive and everybody needs their own space and everybody has to have their own voice heard. And yet, from a service user perspective, and I suppose from a funder perspective, it makes a lot of sense around value for money that everybody is kind of collaborating around the same thing. Did you meet much resistance? Was it difficult to get people to sit down and collaborate and share?
Oh, incredibly difficult. Incredibly difficult. I mean, when we started, I think we looked, there were 733 registered charities for blind and partially sighted in the UK. So no wonder, obviously, there was a bit of friction and duplication. You had the big charities were seemingly not at war with each other, but certainly had no linked services. The medical profession, which it also covers, they were very rarely in the same room of optometry, ophthalmology, orthoptists, etc. And then you had the social sector, which really didn't have any link into the voluntary sector. And those four units, social work, the voluntary sector, and the whole medical aspect, just didn't communicate. So it was not surprising then that when someone entered the sight loss journey, and most people enter it in their 50s and 60s, not as children, there was total confusion and lack of clarity and lack of help.
And were the partners or all the pieces in this jigsaw that you were trying to put together, were they willing? Did they see the value in the bigger picture that you were trying to create, do you think?
Well, I think eventually, yes. I mean, to be fair, the big charities, the big voluntary sector charities for the vision impaired, they had to put their money where their mouth was. So the big ones stuck in, I think it was £20,000 each. I think five of them put that amount in. And that was how we then managed to structure Vision 2020 and get it going. And by the time I left, you had to be a health, a voluntary sector or a social services sort of linkage. You had to be that doing that on a sort of national basis to be a member. And we had 54 members at the end with a sliding scale. I think there were eight different sliding scales from, you know, minimal charities up to sort of 10, 20,000, up to charities of an income of over 10 million or whatever. So it was a sliding scale and they all paid accordingly. And that was a big leap of faith. They put the money where the mouth is, and therefore that was an incentive for them to say, actually, we probably could do things better now.
And as a brand, of course, the Vision 2020 UK, you know, the events and conferences and all these things you've organised have become kind of, you know, legendary now. You know, people are travelling to these things, or at least were before the pandemic, and they will again, I'm sure.
Well, the problem now is that the Vision 2020 then became Vision UK, and that sadly has now ceased to operate because of the pandemic and the funding. So that's now gone into liquidation, as it were.
Okay.
But the spirit of collaboration has now sort of rekindled. So there is a children's group across sector that one of the groups are sort of coordinating, running, and that's a sort of pan organizational group. There are a couple of other initiatives with some of the big charities, but it's not quite the same in terms of having health, social care, and the voluntary sector all together under one sort of umbrella group. But it is operating.
Yeah, and you'd hope that the work that was done in the past will keep those groups together and keep them talking. I suppose that's a big thing.
Yes, because we did a massive piece of Network 1000 was the biggest, I think it's still the biggest piece of research on vision impairment in the UK. 1,000 people nationwide and right the way through to everything from employment to income, etc. So big pieces of stuff that we were able to do, say the conferences, and getting quite, you know, the level of cooperation now is massively, massively more than it ever was. And that I think was as a result of the work that Vision 2020 managed to establish.
I want to talk to you about two other areas, and we'll come to sport in a minute because I know it's played a huge part in your life, and I'd be keen to have a bit of a chat about it. But before that, because we are somewhat a technology podcast, I want to touch on technology. And you and I, when we were chatting about this interview a couple of weeks ago, you mentioned a device to me that I have remembered seeing in the 80s, the VersaBraille.
Yes.
And you were talking about that, and I was thinking, oh my God, remember the VersaBraille? And then I was talking to somebody else about the VersaBraille since. That was a great piece of technology in its day, wasn't it?
Well, it was innovation. I mean, I'm working in social work in the 80s. I'm now trying to type my reports for the court. I'm trying to eventually look at other people's information, etc. And of course, you couldn't do any of that unless you had a reader, which she was with me for years and years and years, and be able to read everything. And suddenly I had this briefcase with a cassette in it that allowed me to have a braille output, but also then to be able to braille in and write a report and then get it printed. And I just thought this was amazing. I thought it's never going to get any better than
this,
is it?
I know. Yeah. And now you look at all the stuff we have. And were you using the one that used cassette tapes to save its
documents? Yeah. The cassette tape was what triggered it into a computer rather than a cassette player, because you could play music on it.
That's right.
Audio, and then you had the record bit of it that allowed you to imprint the data and then send that to a printer. And then I went on to VersaText, which was using the box as the input, and then it had a 5¼-inch floppy disk in it, in a square box. Again, still no screen, so no one else could see what you were up to. And then we went into DOS and an actual computer, which was a massive step forward. The big problem really was using and learning and advancing all this technology while you were then trying to do a full-time job. So you mentioned about going the extra mile. It's been that every case, every time a new piece of kit has been introduced, you've then had to largely do all of that in your own time to get up to speed and to deal with it.
What are you using nowadays, I suppose, tech-wise? I presume, you know, if you ask someone the question, what piece of technology do you never leave home without? I presume you have your mobile phone with you all the time, do you?
Mobile phone. I've been a Braille input user as well, so I have an Apex, which mm-hmm. I'm just about to upgrade because it's seen better days. I use the Victor Stream to listen to my books. I've still got a Book Sense, which I'm still trying to get a battery for. I'm, you know, all of those old bits of kit. In the house, I use a laptop, a BrailleLint 40 display, with a keyboard, and then obviously I've got everything from Amazon Echoes and various other wireless type products on apps to utilize. So, you know, I said once, you know, I think it's fairly reasonable in our house, and my wife said everything talks, and I said, oh, that's an exaggeration. And then I found that 43 of my devices.
She's right.
Did.
Yeah.
So I think
and isn't it interesting that the stuff that talks nowadays is a lot of it is mainstream tech that might be in anybody else's house?
Yes, very much so. I mean, obviously, all the Amazon devices and the various other bits and pieces, and of course, you know, the iPhones and stuff were just standard tech now for so many people.
So tell me about, we touched on it at the start, we were talking about the Paralympics and the Olympics opening ceremony, of course, taking place around the time that we're recording this piece. By the time people are listening to this, the Olympics will be up and running. Sport's been a huge thing in your life. I mean, on the day that you lost your vision, I think you said you were playing sport. And it sounds like from reading your website, but also from listening to you today, it sounds like sport was one of the big things that probably got you through that sight loss journey initially anyway.
Yeah, very much so. As I say, going to a school where there were other kids that were congenitally blind that had amazing skills with the football, with cricket, with anything you could think of. And I thought, well, if they can do it, why shouldn't I? So they were a good spur with me, that competitive bit as a young kid. And then suddenly you got noticed for things other than your blindness, that you could do something that people couldn't imagine blind people doing, you know, whether it be playing football or cricket or doing athletics or rowing or whatever. And so that was an incredible feeling, that you were challenging people's perceptions and challenging your own perceptions. And you mentioned the family. I mean, I didn't really have a choice whether I coped or not. You just got on with it. My family were obviously devastated. They couldn't see a future for me. They couldn't see me ever getting a job or getting married, because suddenly I was blind. And they'd never experienced anyone with sight loss either in the family. So for me, it was almost trying to cope for their benefit as well as my own.
And maybe, you know, I suppose then throwing yourself into sport, because it's something clearly you enjoyed prior to sight loss, something you realised, hang on, I can do this thing with sight loss. And this is going to show people around me that actually this doesn't make a difference.
Yes. And I think there was a slight advantage, because some of the skills that I developed as a sighted child, I was still young enough to transfer and learn to do those slightly differently. But the skills were still there, and be able to get quite good at the cricket or the football or the athletics was probably an easier transition. And then obviously getting up to a stage where, having set a sports club up, we then started to get more and more invitations to do a whole range of different sports, which for me has just been fantastic.
What was it like being involved with Paralympics? I know you were heavily involved with the GB team and travelling with them and going to some of the games. What was that like?
I think the evolution of the sport was for me been the biggest achievement, really. When I set up Metro Sports Club, you know, there was no sporting activities to speak of for you know, after school. Certainly in London, and so setting up a sports club then started to convince people that you could do more. We then got asked if we'd like to try skiing, and so a few of us from Metro went over to Norway to try skiing, and for me that was it. I just found a sport that you were free of holding on to someone or whatever. You just had a guide who talked you through both the alpine and then mainly cross country is what I did. And suddenly that freedom, being out in the mountain, for me was just so exhilarating. And then 2 years after we'd started all of that, they said, oh, we're trialling for the first winter Paralympics in Sweden. Would you like to trial for it? So I trialled and got in to the games, competed in Sweden, and then four other Paralympic winter games after that. And then we were talking about the social a bit. One of the things that's been really quite important is when I was working with the kids, you're wanting them to have the sorts of opportunities that they had been denied and couldn't get. In the sport, it was exactly the same. So a lot of the work post-competing has been trying to get people to have the sort of opportunities that I've had in sport, you know, and what it's given to me in sport, others could then have and share. So it's been a sort of long-term link for that. And then obviously getting involved with running the Paralympic Association and then being on the bid team for London 2012 was the icing on the cake. I mean, it was really the peak of the career.
Because London is, and I know we started touching this at the start, but London really, London 2012 was where Paralympics, I guess, came into another dimension, didn't they? Like, I remember even here in the media, it was all over the place. It was everywhere, much more than maybe prior in, you know, when it was in Beijing or in Sydney or anywhere else.
Oh, no, very much so. I think if you look at 2012, They were, I think, the first event that I've been to. I've been to 13 different Paralympics, winter and summer. And I would say that the Paralympics in London were the first truly event that was regarded as a sports event for people with a disability as opposed to a disabled sports event. Mm. And in Beijing, for instance, at the athletics, during the 10 days of competition, I think they reckoned there was about 100 to 120,000 spectators in the whole of the 10 days in a sort of 80,000, 90,000 stadium. So, you know, roughly 10,000 per day. In one day in London, we had 175,000 spectators in one day in the athletics. And so that's why the athletes would always bid for London to potentially have the Paralympics every year, every 4 years. Because,
but also in turn, that must have, or that must even still have created much more open conversation around what is meant by having disability. And, you know, it just must have opened people up to that and be able to talk about it more.
The advert for the Paralympics in London was ability in action, and that's exactly what it was. You know, you very often didn't see the disability; all you just saw was the ability of the performer. And I think that's been prominent with sponsors, which are, you know, and nothing happens in these situations without money backup. But you know, we had more people wanting to sponsor Paralympic sport than we did initially the Olympic sport, because they saw the benefits of that. They saw it also part of their branding. So that was the first time that had ever really happened, that we were seen as a product that people wanted to be associated with, as opposed to a charitable case that this was nice and benevolent, but only if we had the time or the money.
I really appreciate you coming along today to chat to us. But before we let you go, you've had an incredible career. You've done lots of things, as we've kind of had a snapshot over the last little while, both sporting and in your work life. But as you kind of look back now, and as you maybe think about people who are at the other end, who are starting their career, blind people, and we know that the figures in the UK and here in Ireland, I think in general around the world, they're pretty bad in terms of numbers of people who are in the workplace, you know, are very low. What do you think needs to change? What do you think can happen to make those figures and to make the chances and the future for the blind community in terms of finding meaningful work? What do you think could be done to make that better?
I think that things are moving marginally forward in that there are more images of people with a disability and blindness. We're often portrayed as either superheroes or the needy and things that we need to do things for. Mm. So trying to get almost that as a sense of normality, that you know, you being able to work, you being able to use a computer, you being able to travel is not superhuman. It's usually the result of blooming hard work on your part, on my part. And it's getting that level of understanding through. And it'd be interesting to see post-pandemic, where the things like the reasonable adjustment, if people are able to work from home and have shown effectively and efficiently they can work from home, then a number of the barriers may well have be removed that would suddenly make someone think, well, actually, if they can do it at home, why couldn't a blind person? The other side of that, obviously, is isolation and not getting some of the other buzzes from work. But I think it's gradually eroding the whole notion that disability means inability. And the more people we've got around that can challenge that can be held up and just be shown as doing a day-to-day job. And if we can start to support each other better, I think social media now has really added another dimension to all of that, because you know, recently I've had a problem with some technology issue, and others have posted it, and you've got a solution. Yeah. Someone's come back and said, if you do this, that, and the other. Now, in the past, I wouldn't have known where to go. So I think we're going to be better at helping each other as well and being vocal about it. I think we have been largely a very silent minority, and I think we need to, perhaps do a little bit more, not shouting and screaming about it, but actually, you know, challenging concepts, challenging issues. It's been interesting recently with the advent of the e-scooters and suddenly, a voice of vision impaired people in peril on the streets is growing some sort of dimension.
There's some great words to bring this to a close, and let's hope we can all keep that going into the future. Mike, it's been lovely to chat to you. It's been really nice, just to get to know you a little bit more, and for our listeners to get to know you. So thanks very much for taking the time. Stay safe and well, and I hope we will catch up with you again. But for the moment, thanks a million.
Great pleasure.
Many thanks to Mike Brace. I thoroughly enjoyed that chat, and have to say, Mike left us with some very positive words for how we can, I think, all support each other in the future to make sure that the life of blind and low vision people right across the world can only get better. That's all for this edition of Desert Island Tech. I'm back soon from Stuart Lawler and everybody at Sight and Sound Technology. Bye-bye.